Solmaz Sharif has received a Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award and fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Poetry Foundation. Her poetry has appeared in Granta, The New Republic, and Poetry. She is a Jones Lecturer at Stanford University. Look is her first book. Solmaz, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much for having me, Daniel.
And congratulations with this book. And I congratulate you on two levels. One, for writing such an amazing book. It was a surprise. Every poem was another surprise. And the images and the, you know, the connections and the use of language, everything was just really a wonderful, beautiful read. Congratulations on that level. But also congratulations on the fact that this is really getting some good reviews and some good attention, including a recent review in the New York Times.
Right. Thank you so much. Very surprising.
Yeah, you didn't expect all this.
No, I did not. Especially, you know, it's a book that I've been working on for many, many years and been trying to be rather resilient about. So it's especially gratifying, I think, to
see
a first book of poems. Yeah. Receive the kind of attention that it is, yeah.
And, you know, whenever one looks up this book or, you know, reads the reviews or reads about the book, one of the first things that the reviewers do is articulate the premise of the book, and specifically about the language in the Dictionary of Military Terms and how that feeds into the creativity and the form of the book. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. The book, in part, deals with the U.S. Department of Defense's Dictionary of Military and Associated Terms, which is a public document and is a dictionary that attempts to supplement quote-unquote standard English dictionaries and standardize military correspondence. I use terms from that dictionary throughout the book. The book began as a kind of poetic rewrite of the dictionary, trying to expose the truth behind the terms that the military uses to euphemisms that the military might use to explain warfare. But then it evolved into just really trying to place those terms in an everyday U.S. context and show how this violence is really permeating everything we do in this nation and how we live our lives in this nation. So the book tries to intervene in that rewriting of the English language.
I think one of the well-known euphemism is that of friendly fire.
You know, which
sounds nice, but, you know, obviously isn't. But the euphemism that I think is fantastic, I mean, on so many imaginative and really kind of sad levels, is the use of the word look itself, which is the title of the book. Can you tell us what that means in military jargon?
Yes. The Department of Defense had redefined look to mean, in mine warfare, the period in which a mind circuit is receptive of an influence.
I.e., it can go off any time.
Exactly.
As long as somebody is on it.
Right. That being the influence, right?
Yeah.
Well, that even in the definition, we're seeing a euphemism in action.
I assume that as a poet, a lot of times, you know, your thought is intimately entwined with your rhythm and your language and the images. But I don't know how much thought went into that look, but I love the idea that you can go through this book and at any time a bomb can go off.
It was the first title for the book, and I tried other titles, but none of them worked quite like look does.
Right.
Because so much of it is also about what we choose to look at and what we choose to look away from and what it means to actually look at atrocity and name the lives that are being lost around us.
It seems to be, at least based on what I've read and what I'm hearing, it seems to be that the idea of this book perhaps came before the poems. Is that true?
Yes.
One of the wonderful things about the writing process is how repeatedly we're surprised by what goes on in our own work. And I imagine that a lot of times when poets put books together, they don't discover the form or even the ideas behind the books until they have, you know, like a certain amount of poems. And then they say, oh, my God, I'm writing about divorce, or, oh, my God, I'm writing about you know, racism or whatever it is. But you knowing what you were going to write about, I imagine the surprises had to come from different areas. What were the biggest surprises for you in this book?
I think the biggest surprises were the shift between treating it as a kind of poetic dictionary into treating it as a book of poems and trying to figure out. The problem I was running into is that basically I was using the terms of the military to describe Afghanistan and Iraq specifically, and thereby committing the same violence against these people and these nations, and really just narrowing the narrative of those nations to ones of warfare that's being described by the military, despite my best intentions. So I started to ask myself, you know, what would happen if a debutante were forced to use this language? What would happen if the Department of Homeland Security threw an orgy and they had to use this language? I was just trying to figure out what would happen if everyday American lives that see themselves maybe apart from or independent of these, this violence were forced to contend with this violence. And I think that was a major shift in the book. And the other major shift was a long elegy that I have in there that I wrote for an uncle of mine that was killed in the Iran-Iraq War. And that's something that takes the book and something that takes the military language outside of just the nation that it's specific to, the U.S., you know, the U.S. Department of Defense, and tries to talk about it as a tactic that is global in nature, a tactic that any state would have to use to kind of explain and excuse its violence.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting about, you know, a lot of books of poems. You can pretty much predict the form of the poems after a while. You can kind of predict within a, you know, a reasonable limit, of course, because there's always going to be some surprises. And what's interesting about this book is you cannot predict what is going to come next and how you're going to approach it. And one poem might be a like lay down, you know, just really short lines. And then another one might be a prose poem, and then there might be a list, and then they're just, it's incredibly unpredictable. How do you decide from poem to poem how the poem is going to be written? Or is it a decision, or is it just something that comes organically?
Oh, it's hard to say. You know, I feel like there are different answers for different poems individually, but I do know that no single formal answer seemed enough to respond to the immensity of the violence that I was trying to respond to. So that, you know, I write a list poem, and then I realize that's also not enough. Like, actually, we need a narrative poem that unpacks one of those operation names, for example. And that's also not enough. We need some Wikipedia language in there to look at how that deals with warfare. And I just really, for me, it was important that the book try to talk about as much as possible, as diversely as possible, and to try to make it inescapable, really, to make warfare inescapable as it actually is.
Well, you managed to, and this is something that not very many people can manage, you managed to have a book of poems that's quite frankly a page turner. I want to know what's going to happen in the next poem.
Thanks.
I like how the poems oftentimes land in the seemingly personal with a speaker of the poem, and then they, you know, and then they exit the personal, and, you know, and they're able to, you know, in very omniscient ways look at the, you know, the subjects or the things, you know, from multiple ways. But one of the strains of the poem is how it just, it'll land through some sort of perception and give us a really powerful image, like this, for example. It says, this is from the poem Look. The speaker's describing, you know, worn, torn country, and it says, we walked by the villas, the faces of buildings torn off into dioramas, and recorded it on a handheld camcorder. It's a wonderful image. I mean, that the whole diorama thing's just, I mean, it's just, you just see it. But I'm wondering, are a lot of these images of war personal to you?
Maybe in some way, and yes, and also I did a lot of research. I think we live in an era where these images are so readily accessible to us on the internet and within the news media, and I think the context in which we are exposed to them really changes the way that we might see or not see those very images. And that's one of the powers of the poem, is that even if I gave you a photograph of buildings that look like dioramas in a New York Times article, for example, and the article is just listing off the kind of factual basics of a battle that ensued, you will have a different reaction to it as a reader and a viewer versus finding that same image within a love poem, right?
Or finding.
So the poem offers us the ability to both recontextualize the image and also to take advantage of the openness that a reader approaches a poem with, you know, and a reader approaches a poem expecting maybe a language of love and expecting to be surprised by images and to create connections between images. So it's a much more active kind of participation rather than one that you would find reading the news.
And then, of course, some of the poems will go into the speaker herself. And yeah, I'm not going to say it's you because I, you know, obviously I don't know you. But like in the opening poem, which is wonderful because it's like a resolution. This book is going to be about this. Whereas I love that repetition, you know, like you're getting us ready to enter into this text. But there's a moment where the speaker is called exquisite by her lover, which, you know, is a way of exoticizing the woman of color. And occasionally it does go into these incredibly personal moments. And is that something that came about thematically for you? Or is it something that just maybe you can't separate the personal from the global?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely can't separate the personal from the global. And I think that much of our failures around political discourse and around political change, more specifically, are failures to connect the two and keep the two connected as much and as long as possible. It was very important for me that the erotic moment and the erotic language happen alongside these moments of violence and these moments of terror because that's how we live them. Actually, you know, I think for some of us, our lives are inseparable. No, there's no moment of our life that is private enough to keep the political out of it, or to keep the military out of it, or to keep the police out of it. And so, it just feels like a natural kind of marriage to me.
Yeah, and
the poet Muriel Rukeyser talks about it as not so much as bringing things together, but as refusing to allow them to be torn apart.
Right,
and that's how I see it too.
The fact is that language that is used to justify or to hide or to whitewash violence is certainly used on cultural, racial levels. I'm thinking of Evelina Galang's anthology that came out, I don't know, 10, 20 years ago called Screaming Monkeys. And the incident was simply an article in the Chicago Tribune about this store owned by Filipinos. And when their children came out, the writer referred to them as screaming monkeys. And you know, it's that kind of that loose use of language that sometimes, you know, in itself is incredibly violent. And so, yeah, I do see the connection and it makes a lot of sense.
Right.
Can I ask you about your use of white space? I think one of the things that makes this book so readable, I'm talking to Solmaz Sharif and we're talking about her new collection of poems called Look. The reasons why this book is such a pleasure to read is not only does every poem kind of surprise you about, you know, its form, its structure, what it does, going from, you know, the poignant to the funny, which is also very poignant. But it also uses white space in really interesting ways. And can you tell us about how you use white space? What do you do with it?
For me, a poem is in part a visual form.
Right.
And so I try to take advantage of that. I think one of the more notable places that I use white space is in a series of poems called Reaching Guantanamo that are imagined letters to a Guantanamo inmate and are based on a New York Times article that I had read in 2008 about Salim Hamdan, who was a detainee. And in it, there was just an aside that says the mail that arrives is heavily censored. So much of a poem is actually about silence, you know, and so much of a poem is actually about what is left out. And I wanted to see, well, what would that happen in a moment where that leaving out and that erasure is politically decided, you know, and is an act of political violence? And can that white space and that silence be a kind of maybe an entry for a kind of radical empathy, or at least a moment of grief that everyone can enter? So that was like one of the considerations I had in using it. I mean, for me, formal decisions are political decisions. That's how it works in my head. And so what does it mean to use white space or silence? You know, like what narratives are also silent, and how can we highlight that silencing and that erasure that happens on a state level, on a political level, on a racial level, you know, and use the poem to do that.
You use white space quite generously in Ground Visibility, the poem Ground Visibility, where there's really a lot of white space, you know, between the stanzas and also even a mark, you know, separating the stanzas. But really what I was getting to with that question was the Dear Salim poems. I think they're just they're one of the most incredible uses of white space I've ever seen. I'm going to read a line just so the reader can kind of have a sense of what we're talking about. The poem, one of them starts, Dear Salim said I need to, my tongue, it's getting sharp. I told him to, his own business, to his own wife. That's beautiful because I love how half Thank of the you. Narrative is just falling out. It's just not there. Mm-hmm. And that half of the narrative really works on an incredibly thematic level in the book itself. What is missing? What is not there because of the violence?
And I wanted it to really be unpredictable what was missing, you know? Some of those blanks and some of those absences seem really obvious, you know, what might be there, what word might be there. And so, and that's usually how redaction and censorship works, right? Is to create a really spiritually maddening environment for the recipient where you start to question your own, well, is that actually what it says? Or it must be something that has higher stakes than that, or... And it can become rather crazy making in that kind of way.
Yeah, and the fact that we can't really anticipate all the missing words really makes us feel like we're missing something.
Right. Yeah. Right. You're constantly off guard and off kilter and destabilized.
You know, you have this one poem that really struck me as a writer of color. It's called Desired Appreciation. You said, until now that I've reached my 30s, all my muse's poetry has been harmless. And it reminds me of my experience and experience of many people of color in the MFA, especially when they go to a traditional program. And I went to the University of Oregon. That's where I got my MFA. Mm-hmm. And although I was there with Chang Ray Lee and Andres Montoya, we were still, you know, you could still kind of find that the culture itself might, you know, encourage or discourage a person of color. And I'm wondering how your MFA experience was. Did you find it to be like, okay, this is really difficult?
You know, first I want to say that that line is actually taken from a translation of Ovid's poem, Ibis, which is a curse poem that he wrote when he was in exile. And it's a really elaborate and long curse poem, and it's a failure of a poem in many ways. But I had to use it when I saw it. As for MFA, I had a really fortunate experience as an undergrad where I got to work with a program that June Jordan had established called Poetry for the People, where all we read was work by writers of color in translation, in English, and it was on us to teach that work and to create, you know, a socio-historical context for that work to be understood and appreciated. This was happening outside of the English department, obviously. Uh-huh. This was happening in the African-American Studies department, more specifically. So when I applied to MFA programs, I knew what I was getting into, you know, or I knew that it was not going to be Poetry for the People anymore, and that it was going to be a different drawing room of sorts. So I felt prepared for it. And I always thought of it and these various institutions, I always think of them as surfaces to sharpen myself again. And I'm always trying to ask, you know, how can I make it so that the conversations, the political conversations that I think are absolutely essential to us as human beings cannot be ignored in the room that they are in.
Right.
You know, how can I make these political conversations so part and parcel to the formal decisions that are being made, so that even if I find myself in a workshop that wants to talk only about form and not about content, they will end up talking about power because they have to. I was also rather lucky in that I went to NYU and I got to study with Sharon Olds and I got to study with Youssef Komunyakaa, and their support and challenge was really incredible, and it wasn't as hostile of a place as some other MFA programs can be, or I've heard them to be. Yeah, I went in knowing that it was going to be different than the community I necessarily seek out and the work I necessarily seek out, and I was ready to hear it.
Right. Well, that's good that you prepared for that. I think what happens with a lot of writers of color is, and I know this happened to me. I was very young when I went into the MFA program. I went in there saying, "White people, you're going to have to hear what I have to say," you know.
Right.
And I was very, very, you know, assertive of my politics. And Andres Montoya, the deceased poet, and I used to call Cracker Craft, because we thought it was, you know, could try to take away our voice, and they wanted us to write Macs with salsa. But to go in there with the idea, okay, I'm going to learn what I can from this experience. And then, of course, having Yusuf Komunyakaa and these great poets at NYU, I mean, that's just amazing. But it sounds like you've been focused on your poetry for a long time, and you knew what you wanted out of that program. And perhaps you know what you want out of this first book, and do you know what you want for a second book?
I'm thinking about it, but I'm also, you know, I'm going back to what poems are, which are things that are written one by one, without a necessarily strong conceptual frame.
Right.
But my obsessions remain around gender and race and class and nationality and all of that stuff, and a speaking back to power and how that might be done in a poem. All of that remains.
So your next book might very well be just, you get to a point where there's a series of poems and you say, okay, well, this one could stay in, these can stay out, and maybe write a few more in order to encourage the organic form of the book, I guess
right,
you can say.
Right.
Well, that'll be an interesting
book. I'm very excited for it, yeah. I've been doing more translation, and that I'm excited by. Just have another poet's voice in my head.
Yeah.
Rather than my own, has been really gratifying.
Well, you are a first book poet. You're a young poet, and I'm sure you have a lot more books to come, and I can't wait to see
every single
one of them. Would you be willing to read a poem from Look before we sign off?
Sure. Would it be all right if I read Desired Appreciation?
Absolutely.
It? So Desired Appreciation. Until now that I've reached my 30s, all my muse's poetry has been harmless, American and diplomatic. A learned helplessness is what psychologists call it, my docile desired state. I've been largely well-behaved and gracious. I've learned the doctors learned of learned helplessness by shocking dogs. Eventually, we things give up. Am I grateful to be here? Someone eventually asks if I love this country. In between the helplessness, the agents, the nation must administer a bit of hope. Must meet basic dietary needs, ensure by tube, by nose, by throat, by other orifice, must fist bump a janitor, must muss up some kid's hair and let him loose around the Oval Office. Click, click, could be cameras or the teeth of handcuffs closing to fix the arms overhead. There must be a doctor on hand to ensure the shoulders do not dislocate, and there must be Prince's raspberry beret. Click, click, could be Morse code tapped out against a coffin wall to the neighboring coffin. Outside my window, the snow lights cobalt for a bit at dusk, and I'm surprised every second of it. I had never seen the country like this. Somehow I can't say yes. This is a beautiful country. I have not cast my eyes over it before, that is, in this direction. It's how John Brown put it when he looked out from the scaffold. I feel like I must muzzle myself, I told my psychiatrist. Do you feel dangerous? She said. Yes. Do you feel like a threat? Yes. Why was I so surprised to hear it?
That was Solmaz Sharif reading Desired Appreciation from her new book of poems. Look, you know, I have to say I have a line underlined in this poem. The click, click could be the cameras or the teeth of handcuffs closing to fix the arms overhead. I love how that sound, click, click, even that sound increases in tension with those following lines. Beautiful book. I wish you the best of luck
on
this.
Thank you so much, Daniel. Thank you so much.